Our speaker today is Sharon Weaver. Sharon earned a master's degree in divinity at Vanderbilt University, and she has held work positions as a teacher, social worker, and college professor. Sharon currently operates a consulting company called Spiritual Care Providers. The title of Sharon's sermon is Do Your Homework, Criticizing Without Knowing the Facts. Let's welcome Sharon.
Hi. Oh man, it's so good to be back, especially after being sick. It's really good to be back. It's really good to be anywhere, but especially to be here at home with people I love, and I feel your love and your tolerance of me and all these years, and I just want to thank you. I'm going to start out and I'm going to repeat words that are critical, and I hate to do that, but and I want to put a caveat in. When Jill called me to get a title, emailed me, I think, I knew what I wanted. I work on things a lot in here ahead of time. But I didn't know what to say, and so criticizing comes out, and the title sort of sounds like, do your homework, and then it's okay to criticize. Let me just say, no. It's not. Sorry about that. That's a lousy title. It's not what it's about. And I'll tell you what got me thinking about this was an article I read, and I won't even mention the person's name, although you'll know, and we can talk about it in second hour if you desire. But the title of the article that caught my eye, because I don't normally read this person, was Ebola Doc's Condition Downgraded to Idiotic. Now, this is when Dr. Brantley had just been airlifted to Emory University and was in very critical condition. And there's nothing like kicking someone when they're down, right? So I thought, well, what is this about? And so I read it, knowing that the author typically is very a critical person, someone I actually have felt sympathy for in having to live with herself, but that's another issue. I'll read you how it started out, and it was a short article, and you can find it on her website, and I have a copy of it, but it intrigued me, and there's, I have to tell you, there's parts of me that went, well, that's a good question, you know, why are they doing that? And then, I have to battle with some of my own reasons I want to criticize. It starts out, I wonder how the Ebola doctor feels now that his humanitarian trip has cost a Christian charity much more than any services he rendered. What was the point? Why did Dr. Brantley have to go to Africa? The very first risk factor listed by the Mayo Clinic for Ebola is an incurable disease with a 90% fatality rate, is travel to Africa. She went on to refer to such localities where mission trips go as disease-ridden cesspools. Yeah, little. So I will say this person is very much an equal opportunity offender. I mean, she paints with a wide brush in this article and just really has evidently had a bone to pick about this. She was really very strong about it. And at first I thought, She ended up referring to Christian narcissism, which is a valid criticism or a valid concern. You know, what is this Christian narcissism that has people becoming missionaries and going throughout the world to say, look, my way's better than yours and my God's better than yours, and I'm going to show you the right way or the way that I think you should go. I understand that. And tend to agree with that there's a problem with going forth and telling others how imperfect they are and what's wrong with them. When it comes to the missionary work that's usually associated with Christianity, but it does a couple of things. It assumes that the only people going out are Christians. And it also assumes that the only reason they go out is to proselytize and change people into Christians. And so I got to thinking about that, and I got to thinking about what Dr. Brantley might feel if he read that, and what his wife might feel or family might feel. They were mentioned in there too. And why she had to write that. The only answer I could come up with that is you must feel that you have really a self-inflated, maybe a narcissistic, if you want to point fingers, a very self-inflated view of your own opinion. And I thought, even if you are, and everybody sometimes spouts off opinions, well, why did you even go? I thought, well, let's look at why. She brought forward some questions. Let's look at why. Why did he go? I mean, first of all, did it cost more than the services he rendered to bring him back, to jet fly him back? No. He works for Samaritan's Purse, which is a charity near my hometown. And Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son, is the founder the CEO or president of it, runs it. And he responded by saying, that's not nearly our budget. You know, he did not touch our budget. And our budget is to do the very thing that we've asked him to do, to go out into the world. And so within that, one, there wasn't the homework done on what did it cost compared to what they had to spend, which we could argue is that, you know, we could criticize, well, is that how you should spend it? But nevertheless, and there's a problem with the question. One of the things that I did learn from Vanderbilt is you're not going to get the answers out of them. We're not going to probably get a lot of the answers in life, but hopefully we can learn to ask better questions. So when you ask, and to recognize the questions that are not even the questions to ask, when she says, I wonder how the Ebola doctor feels now this humanitarian trip has cost a Christian charity more than any services rendered, what was the point? More than any services he rendered. Now, place a value on human life. Somebody can. When we do, there's numbers if you want to find it. But human life. Place a value on, if you're a Christian, the value of witnessing. If you're not a Christian, if you're any other faith, if you're someone not of a faith, the value of being present and helping others. Doesn't that teach others the benefits of helping? I mean, that we teach others by our showing our work and how we live. So we tend to think, unless there's money involved, when we see amount over here, it costs this much, and your salary is this, and you help this many people, well, they've lived, and that's in balance, you're not taking in the full cost. The mother that was saved, and then the children she can care for, the father that was saved that can work to then make money for the family. And then there are generations after. How do you put a price on that? How do you put a price on someone sitting in Nashville, Tennessee, reading this article and thinking, wow, at least the man's doing and following what his beliefs are. Am I doing that every day? I might not be headed off to wherever to save cats in a foreign country. But I'm trying to do my best here with what I can do. But it made me think about that. That's not the right question. And the other question, when she criticizes, you know, and talks about why did he have to go to Africa when the very risk factor is Ebola with a disease that's 90% fatality rate. He's a doctor. He's a researcher on post-residency. Many times physicians on post-residency will go out to the very places where they're not going to see the usual. He's also operating under missionary, which put the fear behind you and head out. And I was reading in the Wall Street Journal a couple days later from this article. This was August 16th. And it's unusual you'd quote the Wall Street in response to such a criticism here, but they had the answer. It was an article, and I have the article as well, about how, because of a lack of a box of gloves, Ebola had spread. And it talked about the dire conditions that these, first of all, people, could be us, why not us, these people live in. One clinic finally had to close in July because they had only received one box of gloves, 50 gloves, since April, in the middle of Ebola. And they said, not only Ebola, this is the busiest season for malaria. And they're so paying attention to Ebola that they're not paying attention to malaria and typhoid and the other polio that's creeping back in, the other problems. They were using plastic bags, the garbage bag, the kind of grocery bags we have, using plastic bags to try to treat people because they had no gloves. Gloves. How much is an average box of gloves? I can get them for what? If I go to Bargain Hunt, even cheaper sometimes, but certainly at Walmart and stores, you can get them $5, $6, sometimes $8. Cheaper if you buy them in quantity. People are dying. People are infected because of something that I might use to scoop a litter box with, or we might have just because we didn't want to get our hands dirty when we're cleaning. Certainly clinics, put them on, throw them away, put them on, throw them away. In the United States, there is one physician per 408 people, for every 408 people, according to Wall Street. In Guinea, it's 1 in 10,000. Sierra Leone, 1 in 45,455. And in the hardest hit country, where Dr. Brantley was, it's one physician for every 71,429 people. Why wouldn't he go to Liberia? He went before Ebola. He didn't leave his family. He took them with him because the mission and his belief is to live within and to live among. Took them with him. They went home because of a wedding that he was going to leave and join them. That's why they were even back in the States when he came down with Ebola. Now, I don't know if you've seen, I know you've heard, but if you go online and look, which is a terrible thing to do, but you will see what Ebola does, and it's pretty horrendous, especially untreated. And there's criticisms. He and Nancy Reibol received there was only three vaccines, and she received two and he received one. That's not the only way you live. He also received a pint of blood from a 14-year-old whose life he saved with Ebola. And they're not sure how much the vaccine helped or the blood that he received from someone who had become immune. So maybe the value of it, we don't know yet, is his immunity may help others through his blood in the research we've done. That wouldn't have been done, certainly not hurried like it has been. So I answer to that because she did not do her homework. Now let's just talk a minute about criticism. I want to read another article from Washington Times Community. I won't read it, but it's an article that struck my attention. It's called "Don't Let Criticism Sideline You." Because there's a lot of valid concerns and criticism, concerns about volunteerism and getting involved. You know, no good deed goes unpunished, as they say. And there are problems with getting involved when you don't know what you're doing. I'm always say, do your homework. We now have something called volunteer tourism, where you go out and help for maybe a week. You know, it's sort of like, hi, find me a poor village where I can go help. And what they find is a lot of people go and do more harm, especially when working with children who have been abused, a very population, a lot of people want to help. You go in, you stay, it's all great, and then you check out, you leave, you go back to your home, you've done good work, you feel good, and the child is like, it's sporadic people coming in their life again. So those are good concerns. And it got me thinking about it, because what if we all just stopped because of criticism? And this woman wrote an article, it's a leadership article, just a short one, and she said she was asked to volunteer on a committee where there were two people resigning with complaints of leadership. This really could apply to a church, it could apply to schools, any organization. She said that people had gotten tired of seeing the same people lead. There were accusations of someone, of her, of the volunteer that had asked her to join them, of her being too demanding. Said that the criticism was that they wanted new resource people, and they don't want them to spend so much time on the details of the work that they're doing. They also wanted a greater turnaround when it came to jobs and things that they were asked to do. They wanted to reduce the number of talking heads and get more young people to attend. That made me think, is that a church? She didn't say what it was. Said suggestions were plentiful, but team members were scarce. And what caught my interest in this article was then she talked about soccer. Then she said, let me tell you, I'm a soccer mom, and I've been out to the soccer field to my 14-year-old daughter's soccer team. And I watched. We were sitting on the sidelines, and the suggestions were plentiful for these kids playing soccer. Said the soccer game had multiple viewers and lots of criticism. Run faster. We want you to kick the ball harder. We want you to keep the ball in field more. We want you to trap that speedy ball and turn it. Oops. We want you to kick it between the posts. Score more. And she said, there were lots and lots of criticisms, but not a lot of real suggestions that were helpful. In fact, she goes on to say that the suggestion that they had been given an article, probably by the coach, that suggested even what they deemed helpful criticisms hurt the team. And the coach asked this group of parents to sit silently. I mean, to clap, sure, but not to vocalize suggestions to the team, especially as they were playing. And she said after they did that, they agreed to do that, they did that, and then they watched these other people come in, and she said some fans were downright rowdy. And, you know, really at their own team as well as her child's team. And she said she began to think about the similarities. And she said, here's some recommendations. I thought they were good. That people on the sidelines have opinions about how people in the game are doing, but they're on the sidelines. That play often looks much easier from the sideline than when you're in the game. Vocalized criticism may discourage players. Teams, including parents and fans, may exhibit a spirit of support or criticism. So people around you may support you or criticize you, but they're not actually doing it either way. Keeping an able team is sometimes hard to do over time. Not keeping a team, just an able team, a good team, is hard to do over time. And that even well-intended suggestions were not helpful to players. Sometimes, and I've been under that, even the well-intended, especially ill-timed, can do more damage. It may be saying to the person, you're still falling short. That was a great team. Now, that was a great goal. Now, if you only do this, again, striving for perfection. Criticism. What's the difference? How can I make suggestions? Well, first ask yourself, is it up to you to make the suggestions? You know, are you the one that needs to? Why are they out there playing anyway? Wasn't it to learn and to have fun? There's another article and more suggestions on criticism. And it goes on to discuss, and I want you to think about, and multiple research articles will tell you this. Most of us know it through experience. Criticism doesn't work. It doesn't work. It may work short term, especially if you're under the control of parents, or a spouse, or a worker, or a job. But criticism eventually builds resentment. It builds resentment to the critical person. And it doesn't do anything for someone's self-esteem. It tears it down long term. Some of the difference is, criticism and then feedback, because we do need feedback. We want to know feedback. How do you improve, you know, if you don't sit down and take stock of what you've done? Criticism, here's some suggestions. Criticism implies the worst about another one's personality. You always look for always and never, you know, never words. Feedback is about the behavior, not the personality. You're such an apathetic person. You never do anything. That's criticism. Feedback. It seems like you're sort of tired or you need a little support in here. Can I help you? Can we work on this together? Usually, if you volunteer to help, we'll talk about volunteer in a minute. Criticism devalues. Feedback encourages and supports. Criticism implies blame. Well, we'd have won if you all would have fill in the blank. We could only build this church if fill in the blank. Versus feedback, which focuses on the future. We're going to build this church because we can do some other things. What are some of your ideas? You're going to win in the future. I know you can do it. You're improving every day. Your team can do this. Criticism attempts to control, to coerce, to be coercive. Feedback respects autonomy, and it's not coercive. And then criticism, again, gets to the core of someone and who they are. Feedback says, I'm here with you to help, or I'm just here with you. You person that you are, separate that you are, doing fine. That's a big difference when you think about it. And we read about the criticism and criticizing others, and it seems to become quite easy to do, especially if you have anonymity of sometimes our internet. What if you knew, what if you spoke and you acted as if people knew everything you said and did came from you? Now, I'm not suggesting let's all become paranoid, but I am suggesting to think about the actions and the words that we put out into the world. I love the music today, by the way. Imagine if you could go to someone and talk about a problem and it not be seen through a critical eye. Imagine if you attempted to help do something and no one criticized you, but instead said, if they saw you having trouble, they jumped in and said, you know, let me help. Or maybe we could try it this way. I love that. Maybe we could try it this way. What if, on the other hand, we all stopped volunteering, trying, helping? Who would get this done? Who would be here? It's not pleasant, and it's not good when you're the recipient of it. And I just want to tell you all, as volunteers, I did look this up. I just thought it was interesting. The value of your time in 2013 for the United States was $22.55. They have state-by-state value. Tennessee goes down a bit to 2013, but we're not the lowest. And in 2012, 64.5 million Americans, 26.5% of the adult population, spent 7.9 billion hours of volunteering. Service worth about $175 billion. That would be a lot to lose if we just stopped. I know I'm taking over my time, but I want to just tell you the UUs are with it, which I don't really have to tell you that. But if you'll go online, the UUSC is the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. It fosters social justice, I'm quoting, works toward a world free from oppression, promotes economic justice, bolsters environment, protects civil liberties, and delivers aid with dignity, and advances the rights of people left behind in humanitarian crises. You too can get involved if you wish. There are 15 different countries that the UUSC is involved in, helping and trying to be present in. And I'm glad to talk about that a little bit further. I also want to talk in the second hour about those gloves. We may not be able to help big. I may not be able to go to Liberia, and I wouldn't know what to do when I got there. So I would not be of help. But I can buy a box of gloves, and I can get things mailed. So we'll talk about some stuff second hour. Today, I just want to thank you for your time. Hope I left you some things to think about and maybe forming some different questions. Thank you so much.